Okay, are you there?
Uh-huh.
Okay, this is Jeff Gadiosi, and we are on misplacedstraws.com, and it's a true pleasure to interview just one of the great guitar players and artists of the last 20 years, Mr. Stevie Salas.
Oh, hey. I'm good.
Now, people may know you from your work with Rod Stewart, with Mick Jagger, with all of your solo stuff, but you have this great film out now called Rumble, The Indians Who Lost the World, and that's definitely what I'd like to get into. Before we get deep into the movie, tell me a little about growing up. Was music a big part of your household? What did you listen to? What initially drew you to the guitar?
Well, there's a couple of things. Well, one thing I'm going to make one little correction on your intro there, and it's not a correction that I'm not excited about, but I started playing with Rod Stewart with my first band when I got out of high school. I moved to L.A., and that was actually 30 years ago.
Wow.
And the thought of being this old now is, you know, when you said 20, I was like, God, I wish it was 20 years ago.
Tour, so it makes me feel just as old.
Oh, yeah. I rocked Hartford a couple times at Sports Arena there. I remember that. Mm-hmm. I've actually been there a ton of times from, you know, over the years of touring. When I was a kid, I grew up in, I'm a Native American. But my family, my father and my mother's families had migrated from, my father's family from outside Cheyenne, Wyoming, and my mother's from along the border of the Arizona-New Mexico border. They'd all migrated to California. My father fought in the Korean War. Came back to Camp Pendleton in San Diego, and I grew up on the beach in San Diego surfing. You know, I literally grew up surfing and playing guitar and having this amazing life in Oceanside, California, and Carlsbad, California. And music, I had a stepfather named John Reeder who was an incredible musician in my younger years. So my father and my stepfather, you know, I had this upbringing of both kind of guys, and both were different. My father was a Native American, an amazingly powerful man, wise man. And I also had my stepfather, who was a rock and roll musician. So I had this incredible balance of art and discipline, and I was really lucky. So I was listening to Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton and people like that when I was, you know, pretty much a baby. And so it's ironic, you know, like, you know, Eric Clapton sent me an email recently when I was working on the Rumble stuff, and I think, God, you know, I was listening to Eric Clapton when I was a baby.
Yeah, all these years later, you're still a fan, even though you're peers.
I am a fan, like, you know, even when, you know, playing with Mick Jagger or Steven Tyler, at the end of the day, I look at them up there when I'm on that stage, and I'm like, woo-hoo! I'm still super into it. It's like I'm so excited about it because it's like I am a music fan. I'm a fan of great artists, young and old. And,
right.
But I did have music in my household. I grew up, went to school in San Diego, was going to join the Coast Guard because I also loved the ocean surfing and fishing. And I loved, you know, boats, and I worked on boats. And but I started playing rock and roll when I was about 15. And by the time I was 17, my band was playing high school dances, and we were, my band had a band called This Kids, and we were incredibly popular in San Diego. And I just said, you know, I'm going to ride this music thing out for a while and see what happens. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And then finally, I made the move to, in 1985, to L.A. to give it a shot. And 3 years later, I was playing football stadiums.
That's fantastic. Now, let's talk about the current project, Rumble, The Indians Who Rock the World. It's a documentary that sees you in the role of executive producer. How did the project start? What was it about the story that made you feel you had to be the one to tell it?
Well, what happened was, we'll go back again. Okay, so like I said, I'm in L.A. in 1985. I'm homeless. I'm living on a couch at Badeo Studios. I meet George Clinton from Parliament Funkadelic, and he gives me my first break. I then meet Bootsy Collins, who starts working with me closely, kind of takes me under his wing. I end up producing this weird band called Was Not Was, and we end up with this off-the-wall number one record called Walk the Dinosaur. And then I score an unknown movie called Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure that, you know, I didn't even think was going to come out. And and it went on to make $1 billion. And in all this time, I felt like I was just like everybody else, meaning I didn't notice when I was working with George Clinton and Bootsy Collins that I wasn't black or white or brown or purple or pink or whatever. I never saw color. I never noticed when I was working with Bill and Ted that I was any different than Steve Vai or Joe Satriani or any of those guys. You know, not as great a musician, I'm not saying, but just as a person. I'm an American, right? I felt really I saw things that way, that simple. And once I was in Rod Stewart's band, it dawned on me, you know, that I didn't fit the stereotype. I thought to myself, surely I can't be the only Native American musician that played Madison Square Gardens, you know? So I started to just research musicians, and I started to realize that there are a lot of great Native American musicians out there, you know, that nobody talks about. And the only people that seem to know them were the greatest musicians in the world. And ironically, I was playing with Rod Stewart playing guitar parts that were played by another Native American musician named Jesse Ed Davis 10 years before me. And here I was thinking there was no Native American musicians, and now I was playing one guy's parts, and nobody even knew it, and I didn't know it.
Yeah.
So, you know, this started me thinking about it as a hobby. I wanted to find out more about this, just as a hobby. You know, Native American musicians, this is pretty cool. And then it wasn't until years later, 2003, I think it was, I was up in Canada opening for the Rolling Stones, and a guy called Brian Wright McLeod, a Canadian author, wrote me and asked to interview me for his book because he was doing a documented encyclopedia of all the recorded history by any Native American that ever lived or something. Mm-hmm. Going all the way back in 1908 and wax cylinders. And this guy schooled me. Brian Wright McLeod schooled me on another level that got me excited because by then I would spend a lot of time in Indian country and I would think to myself, Native American people don't have a lot of role models, or at least they don't know they have a lot of role models,
right,
other than people from, you know, 110 years ago, 150 mm-hmm. years ago, you know, and Geronimo and Sitting Bull and all the rest. And I go, here are some people that have inspired the best musicians in the world, and I wanted people to know. So I thought about making a coffee table book, and I thought about doing something just to get the information out there.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a hobby, really, right? It wasn't a money-making thing. And then I met a guy called Tim Johnson, who was the co-director of the Smithsonian National Museum of American Indian. I was giving a speech at a recording studio. And I said to him, it was on an Indian reservation, and I said to him, I go, I find that a lot of Native American people just want to see one Native American in the mainstream. And I kept saying, that's the wrong approach. The approach is to bring the mainstream to Native America. And he thought that was really a good idea. So he invited me down to Washington, D.C. and offered me a job at the Smithsonian. And I told him about this project, this idea I had. And next thing you know, we went into creating an exhibit about it called Up Where We Belong, Natives and Popular Culture. And it went on to become super popular at the Smithsonian. And then I made a film. So that's how it all happened.
Oh, that's an incredible story. And, you know, watching the film, one thing, and you just mentioned it, people knew all of these names but didn't realize their culture. And you show the contributions of people like Charlie Patton and Link Wray and Jimi Hendrix and Robbie Robertson, but they often kind of downplayed their culture. Do you feel it's more acceptable now for artists to be proud of who they are and embrace that culture?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my father, we always knew who we were, but it wasn't like, mm-hmm. you know, Robbie Robertson, the great Robbie Robertson said something to me one day that was really awesome. It was super funny, too. He said, you know, you didn't walk into an audition with your guitar and go, I'm Bob Polansky, I'm Polish. He goes, you just didn't do that. It's all about your playing, all about your music. So you didn't walk around saying, I'm Robbie Robertson, I'm Mohawk Indian. He's Robbie Robertson, man. And I never did either, to tell you the truth, you know. Maybe I would correct some people. I remember, you know, people would ask me what my culture was, and I would let them know. But you just didn't do that because that wasn't what it was about. It was about being a great artist and great musician and being great at your craft. Nowadays, people are more interested in the separatism of everyone's culture and who everyone is. But a lot of times people use that as a crutch, or they use it as an excuse. And I still believe that I don't care if you walk in a room and you're polka dot and, you know, your skin's polka dots and you can kick ass on your instrument. you're going to get the gig. And, you know, I truly believe that.
I completely agree. And one thing is, I was watching the movie, and I have to say, for me, I think the best thing I could say about Rumble is I learned something. You know, there's so many documentaries out there that's kind of recycled the same stories, you know, but I finished Rumble, and, you know, I knew that I learned something. And why do you think it took so long to get this story told? I mean, we're in an age where every band has a documentary. Why do you think it took so long for this story to come out?
I'm not going to lie to you, man. I was just trying to make a positive story, not a race story, not a story about how you screwed us, you took our music, you took our land. I wasn't telling one of those negative race stories. I was just trying to tell a story about some heroes that were heroes of mine and that I had noticed were heroes of Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page and Pete Townsend and, you know, the greatest musician, Slash, and all the greatest musicians that I've worked with and known my, you know, my whole career. These were heroes to them, and I just wanted to tell that story. On a small level, I wanted Native American people to know this story. I didn't ever think it would become a mainstream thing, let alone win Sundance and win three Canadian Academy Screen Awards. And, you know, I didn't do it for that. I wanted Native American people to know that they had some people they could be proud of that can inspire them to let them know that anything is possible. And what happened was, by doing this, we ended up uncovering a ton of stuff that none of us really realized. It just kept going. We just kept going, oh, my God. Oh, my. I mean, this is getting crazy. And luckily, we had the Smithsonian behind us that vetted out this information when Tim and I did the exhibit. So, therefore, we could stand tall. So when somebody would say, come on, that sounds like some bullshit to me, like I said, like, we'll talk to the Smithsonian. It gave us an incredible amount of confidence and power to put this story out and challenge what we've been taught our whole lives. You know, we were always taught Christopher Columbus discovered America. We knew that's bullshit, right? I was always taught that the Delta Blues was a black art form. I was just always taught that. I always assumed that to be, not realizing the whole connection of slaves and Native Americans and New Orleans. And, you know, it's just nobody ever told the story. And I don't know. We just got lucky and we did it.
And, you know, you talk about, like, some of the heroes in there that, you know, really influenced a lot of people. And one of the guys that you spend a lot of time on is the late, great Randy Castillo. For those who don't know, was an amazing drummer who played with Ozzy and Motley Crue and a lot of others. Did you have a relationship with Randy? What made him such an important figure in this story?
Well, I'll tell you right now, I'm not going to be as dramatic and say he saved my life, but Randy got me early on. When I rose up really fast, like I told you in L.A., when I got there in 85 and I was homeless, and within 3 years I was playing stadiums. And I was losing my entire mind, by the way, because I had these dreams of being a rock star, and I'm in private jets, and I'm making tons of money, and I'm you know, I got all the girls and all this, you know, all of it. And there's a balance that goes with that. And I was definitely out of balance, man. I was, you know, out of my mind. And Randy had figured the balance out. Randy knew I was a Native American. Randy befriended me, you know, because we all traveled in some pretty cool circles, you know. Once you get into that upper echelon of those kind of gigs, you know, it's like all of a sudden you're friends with all these other guys. They admire you, you admire them. It's this weird little tiny little private club. It's kind of bizarre. And Randy pulled me aside and he said to me, he goes, you know what you need? And I'm like, well, nope. And he's like, he goes, I'm taking you to Indian country. And I'm like, what the hell's Indian country? I mean, I'd never heard that before, right? I'm not proud to say it, but I mean, I grew up surfing, you know, and playing guitar on the beach. I never got to learn about my culture, but I was desperate to learn more about it. And I was excited to learn more about it. And so he took me. And he told me about his life and how this balanced him out. So we would literally leave Los Angeles in the midst of all-night parties and cocktails and women and drugs and fun and, you know, private jets to London and, you know, backstages. And then we'd go to Taos, New Mexico, and we'd sit out in the middle of nowhere with just a bunch of our Native buddies and play drum, you know, play a drum, play a drum and sing songs and and learn how to be humble and learn how to like relax in a deeper level in the middle of nowhere. And it really made sense to me. And whenever I would start to lose my mind, I would go back to Indian country. And it was Randy Castillo that did that for me. And, I owe him everything. So when I did the Smithsonian exhibit, just so you know, they didn't want Randy in the exhibit at the Smithsonian because it was purely because of ignorance, you know. And I'm not saying they're ignorant people. They just didn't know the power. You know, they knew history. Right. They go, oh, Buffy St. Marie and all these greats, you know, that are like tasty, you know, like everybody's good shows good taste, and Robbie Robertson, the band, and you know, it's all you got to be cool, and you know that whole thing.
But
I'm like, you don't get it.
Yeah.
I'm going. You don't get it, man. Randy Castillo is like a legend, and they could not, you know, they'd only done exhibits where they dealt with art and pottery and artifacts, and you know, they never have an exhibit that dealt with the drummer of Ozzy Osbourne, you know, so. You know, we had to push to get that in there. But once Randy was in there, they started to realize those young people coming through the door at the Smithsonian like crazy. And it was because of Randy, all those heavy metal fans, all those hard rock fans that quite honestly, you know, appreciated, you know, the band, and they appreciated Buffy, and they appreciated, you know, the work that Jesse Ed Davis had done. But to them, it was all about Randy Castillo and his work with Motley and Ozzy. And it brought in a whole other audience of young people, and it was really important to the exhibit.
Yeah, and I think it really does show that, you know, this influence and culture that was, you know, kind of unknown in the music industry really goes across the entire industry. You know, you have the Americana band, you have Hendrix, and now you have, you know, a guy in the metal community. So I think it really does bring the whole story together.
Well, if you're going to call the film, tell a story about how these Native Americans influenced pop music history as we know it, you really had to show it. And we had it covered in every angle. I mean, if you really go back to the beginning, birth of rock and roll, okay, let's go back to jazz, and, you know, and you have Mildred Bailey and Russell Big Chief Moore and some of these guys. And Mildred Bailey, you know, was the first woman to ever have a radio show. And the first person she ever hired was Bing Crosby to be one of her singers, who went on to become the biggest selling recording artist in history until Elvis, I think. You know what I mean? It was like, boom, right out of the box. Then you got Link Wray, who really created the power chord and the distorted guitar, where Jeff Beck, Pete Townsend from The Who, Jimmy Page. You know, Jeff Beck told me that him and Jimmy Page used to play air guitar at his mom's house in his bedroom to Link Wray. And I'm just like, the visualization of Link, Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page as 17-year-old kids jumping around playing air guitar to Link Wray just blew my mind. You know, so they influenced the most important musicians in history in a deep, deep level.
Without a doubt. And now, what's next for Rumble? Are there other artists or bands that, you know, you wanted to feature but just didn't have time? You know, will we see a soundtrack record, anything like that? You know, what's the continuation of this?
Well, Rumble came out. It's won, like, just a ton of awards all over the world. I mean, last week I was just in Hungary with it. You know, the film won Sundance in January 2017, and it's still bananas right now. I mean, we're coming out Independent Lens on PBS in January. I'm going to be doing a bunch of press for it. The film just won't die. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Stevie Van Zandt's company took our film and turned it into a school curriculum now for high schools. So now they're teaching it in history classes in high school, which is funny because I got a D in history when I was in high school.
Well, if they were teaching this, you probably would have been more interested in having an A.
You know, but you know what's funny is that it's just the film won't die. It's just, you know, it's showing in London. I think this week someone asked me if I was going to be there, and I couldn't make it. The film is just getting bigger and bigger, and it's not going away. Now, you know, many people have talked to us about doing a miniseries on it, but to tell you the truth, the film was so hard to make, and it took 5 years of our lives, and none of us are in a big hurry to get it done again. But, you know, the actor Edward James Olmos, I'm sure you know who he is.
Of course, yeah.
But he calls me now because he loves Rumble, and I get to call him Eddie, which is awesome. But he's like, he's like, man, you need to hurry up and make that HBO miniseries on this thing. And I'm like, maybe you got to host it. You got to, like, be the narrator. And he's like, okay, I'll do it. You know, the film has taken on a life of its own. And we'll see what's going to come of it. But a lot of people are doing, like, Taboo from the Black Eyed Peas is doing a doc now, and he's in from my film on a deeper level of some things. And I think you're going to see a lot more things springing from the Rumble story.
I hope so. I mean, would love to see, like I said, a soundtrack or a tour with some of these guys. I think that this is something that's going to be around for a while. This isn't something that you just watch and put away. It really was a film that sticks with you. You know, but what about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Have they reached out at all? Any chances in an exhibit or anything like that based on Rumble at the Hall?
You know, I went to the Hall personally, and we screened the film there. They asked us to come, and I came down and spoke. And I would like – that's one of my dreams I'd like to see. You know, I had a pretty amazing career, and it's still going on, but I didn't quite get to where I needed to get to ever be a Hall of Famer. But I'd like to see Jesse Ed Davis get in there as a side man. We've been working really hard to get Link Ray in. This last year we got Link's song Rumble put in the Hall of Fame jukebox.
There for the induction.
There you go. So I think next year we'll get Link into the Hall of Fame. I mean, I think that's going to happen, and I'm hoping for that. I'll be there. I'm thinking another dream I have would be to have an exhibit in the Hall of Fame based on the Native American influence on our country and music history. That would be fantastic to have a small exhibit in this Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that covers that. And that maybe that's something we can work on, which I would like to work on.
Personally, I think that's something that needs to be there, and I hope that's something that you can do and that the Rock Hall sees, because especially based off of this film, I think that's something that needs to be shown there.
I hope so. I want it to be.
And now, stepping away from the movie for a second, you've had a pretty varied career from, the ace sideman to the solo act. The first Color Code record to me is a classic that still gets listened to regularly. You were the musical director and consultant for American Idol. What's next for Stevie Salas? What do you have coming up?
I started producing television recently, like 2006. I started producing a new TV series in Canada, and I starred in it. And it was fun for me because it was new. Music, I had 20 straight years of just world tours and playing with the biggest people in the world, and creating and making records with amazing people. And I sold a couple of million albums of my own. And thank you for my Color Code album. I sold a couple million Color Code albums. And the first Color Code album was funny because last week I was in Austria and I was in Hungary. I was in Hungary with Rumble, and then I went over to Austria to just sit in for fun as a special guest of Eric Martin from Mr. Big. He asked me to jam with him on his opening night of his European acoustic tour for a live recording they were doing for charity. And when I was there, I signed a bunch of Color Code vinyls. It's like, Jesus, man, this album's 28 years old, and it's still like, that one, Back from the Living and Alternative, those albums are still so big and so popular, and people are still just discovering them. And, I don't know, I had a pretty cool career. I'd go do a world tour of my own, and then I'd be bored, and I'd get to go play with, Terrence and Darby and Duran Duran, or go on tour with Mick Jagger, and be his music director, So I've been really lucky that I get a really good group of people that want to play with me and work with me, and it keeps it fresh. But now my real excitement, well, I shouldn't say that, because last year I worked with a Japanese superstar that's the equivalent of a Steven Tyler of Japan, and it's Koshi Inaba. He sold 100 million records in Japan, and he called me out of the blue and was uninspired and wanted to see if I wanted to write with him. So I flew to Tokyo, and we wrote. Next thing you know, we were doing a Japanese tour that sold out in 3 minutes, and I put together a band with the bass player from Jamiroquai and the drummer of Crowded House and Beck and the keyboard player from Funkadelic. And, so all of a sudden I had another gold album, and I got to, pay the house off, and it was like the good old days. So I'm not getting out of music, and I love playing music, but I'm just picking and choosing musically what I do, because, Steven Tyler calls, I want to play. If Mick Jagger calls, I want to play. I'm producing a band in Rome in November. So I'm still picking and choosing. But mostly I'm really into writing scripts and creating movies and creating television. And I want to take that to another level.
Well, that's great. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk. I encourage everybody, if you haven't yet, see Rumble. I know it's on Amazon Prime. It's premiering on PBS in the winter, I believe, in January. Yep.
January.
So definitely encourage everyone to see it. And Stevie, if, there's any chance of getting this in the Hall of Fame, you definitely have my support to get an exhibit going. So I wish you the best of luck with that. And thank you so much for your time. And hopefully we can hook up sometime or talk again soon. And always stay in touch whenever you have a project coming out.
Right on, man. You enjoy yourself, and thanks very much. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Stevie. Bye.
Bye.